In this edition of Generations, we talk to Dr. David Shapiro, a surgeon, about the little publicized condition of post-operative cognitive dysfunction or memory loss after surgery and why it seems to affect older people more. It's tick season and we speak with Ledge Light Health District and find out what that means for going outdoors and how we can prevent getting tick-borne illnesses like Lyme disease. And Judy Jenks from SeniorCentreCT.org joins us to discuss summertime and the heat and how we can stay healthy and safe in the sun. Hello, I'm Brian Scott-Smith and welcome to Generations, a new podcast for people of your generation. Every year across the country, millions of people go into hospital and have surgery. They'll have some form of anesthesia and afterwards may suffer from some temporary memory loss, which in the most part comes back over a short space of time. But some older people may be affected more long-term with what is being termed post-operative cognitive dysfunction that can last for years, and it's a subject that has divided the medical profession. I recently spoke to Dr. David Shapiro, a surgeon at St. Francis Hospital in Hartford, Connecticut, to find out more. David, ever so many thanks for joining us on Generations.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit more about this condition called POCD.
There is a diagnosis that some refer to as post-operative cognitive dysfunction or post-operative cognitive decline. And many providers in the world since the late 50s have referred to this diagnosis as the experience of having a decline in your ability to understand, perform, or even interact with other people after having had surgery and general anesthesia, or anesthesia of any kind, as a matter of fact.
Now, some of the information that we've been reading about this is everybody can suffer any form of sort of like memory loss from surgery, but POCD seems to be more prevalent, it would appear, in older patients. Is there any sort of information that you can give us as to why that possibly is?
Well, there's probably two reasons for that, or two reasons that we can use to explain it. Number one is the less controversial understanding of what POCD would be, in that people who are a little older may have an existing decline or may be able to compensate for some low-lying dementia or low-lying delirium that manifests itself in their everyday life, but they're able to compensate because they are good communicators or they're active or they're healthy. And when they have an event like a general anesthetic or they have anesthesia with surgery, they come out and they feel like they're not quite themselves. They have difficulty with interaction. They have difficulty with perhaps performing tasks of their everyday. And they notice it possibly because they're unable to compensate for it anymore. Whether that's temporary or long-term, it's unclear. The other challenge is when the elderly perform on neurocognitive tests, those are the tests that we use to determine whether someone is making sense to themselves, understanding communication, understanding the world around them. And there's a dozens and dozens of these tests. When those tests are done after surgery or after a procedure, sometimes people manifest a decline in their ability to perform in that test. The vast majority of the time, those patients have never taken the neurocognitive test before surgery. So it's hard to really figure out where they were and where they are before and after surgery. It makes it a big challenge to get to the answer. And this is why the diagnosis is confusing. Many people don't think it exists, but we know that some patients feel it and notice it, and their family members notice it. So we know there's a decline from their baseline. We know that over time, older patients especially, experience memory loss. Even me, I'm just 45 years old, and I sometimes forget what I did yesterday. Those little things that we notice are less and less compensable when we're older.
There seems to be a suggestion from some information that I've read that it's not the anesthesia itself, but possibly the stress of surgery. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, we do know in the world of surgery that surgery is a very stressful event on our bodies. And we do a number of things to help decrease that stress. Some of those things are as easy as losing 10 pounds before a surgical procedure. Having a patient who has diabetes have their blood sugar much better controlled prior to surgery definitely improves their outcome. There's actually a phenomenon called enhanced recovery after surgery, and it's a program that many hospitals subscribe to. This program offers the opportunity for patients to get optimized before they have their elective surgery. And the most commonly employed technique for the surgery would be for the colon surgery. Someone's having a piece of their large intestine removed, whether it's for cancer or diverticular disease or some other process. We get patients to have something called prehabilitation, prehab, where they exercise, they start a walking program, they get their diabetes if they have it under control, they have their medications for their blood pressure better controlled, and we work with their primary care doctors as surgeons to optimize their performance before surgery. This we know enhances their recovery afterwards, and it includes things like returning to work if they still work, returning to normal activity if they're busy or have full of hobbies, and it helps them to get back to themselves and back to their normal lives faster. Whether this increases the likelihood of them having a cognitive recovery as well has yet to be determined. No one's done that research.
One thing I did want to put to you is that people aren't told of the post-surgical risk of POCD by the medical profession during the process of informed consent. Should that change? And should people be asking more questions?
Asking questions is never a bad thing. We should be honest and clear about what the risks of surgery, anesthesia, and all the things that we do to patients are. The challenge in surgery is that we don't know what the risk is. There's an editorial and a great article in the journal called Anesthesiology. They say that older patients should be reassured that surgery and anesthesia are not implicated in causing persistent cognitive decline or incident to dementia, or these so-called events that happen after surgery. At the same time, if patients experience something, they probably should anticipate what's going to happen.
If somebody goes in for surgery and they feel that post-operatively there is something wrong, what sort of things would you suggest as a medical expert that they should possibly be doing either themselves or by way of maybe speaking to, you know, their doctor?
Well, I think the first thing they need to do is speak to their family members and talk to them and tell them, even before surgery, let me know if I'm acting funny, if something's different. If I'm not doing what you expect me to do, talk to me about it. I think that asking and speaking to their physician is a great thing to do. A lot of providers are wonderfully attentive to their patients' needs, but it's important for them to understand where they are at the beginning. If I'm a healthy person, that means I'm likely to see my physician less. So if someone is elderly and they are about to have surgery, ask about it. Quite often the anesthesiologists and the surgeons will tell them that it's not something that we are concerned with too much because we know that these are not the only causes of this decline, but having had surgery, having the illness that led to the surgery could be the cause in and of itself. And having the opportunity to get it surgically remedied is important, but also making sure that if they're going to take pain medication afterwards, that they minimize the prescription type. If they're taking opiates like morphine or oxycodone, minimize the use of those medications because they can contribute to it. Many anti-nausea medications can lead to confusion or feeling detached. And quite often, pain itself can be very distracting. We often recommend things like exercise programs. Even just a walking program is a great idea. I always recommend my patients who are older to go to yoga or Tai Chi classes because it helps them with their balance, it helps them with their focus, and it seems to help them with their recovery from surgery. Public opinion is out there about what things exist in the world of both clinical dementia, delirium or confusion after surgery, as well as this postoperative cognitive decline. But what we know is that the stronger you are going in and the more attentive you are to your strength and your outcome going out, the better off you're going to do.
Dr. David Shapiro, St. Francis Hospital in Harford, ever so many thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And if you have any concerns about your upcoming surgical procedure or possible post-operative memory loss, then do speak to your physician or your treating hospital's surgical team. The weather has finally turned warmer and summer is here, but so too are the ticks, those little creatures that have a thirst for blood and carry some pretty nasty diseases. Lyme disease is the biggest one associated with ticks and was first diagnosed in Lyme, Connecticut back in the 1970s, and now Lyme disease can be found across the US and even in other parts of the world. So how can you enjoy being outside in the sunshine and also stay safe? Russell Melmed, an epidemiologist at Ledgelight Health District based in New London, Connecticut, gives us some great advice and explains exactly what his job is about.
An epidemiologist is somebody who works in public health, who monitors the health of a population. And I do that in a number of ways. We get disease reports from physicians, from hospitals, from emergency rooms, from other clinical settings. So we get all these reports and we can look to see what's going on with our population. Is there a lot of Lyme disease, for example? Is there more than there used to be? Do we see a lot of people having new types of injuries? Are there rashes of opioid overdoses? So as an epidemiologist, I'm constantly looking at health data and trying to make sense of it.
It is tick season.
What are some of the big things that we need to be watching out for?
Sure. Well, the first thing I'll say about tick season is that really tick season is anytime the temperature rises above 45 degrees. So even in the dead of winter, if you have a warming spell, 45 degrees, everybody likes to get outside. You know, it's February. People start picking up sticks because it's warm. Ticks become active. So, but right now, of course, it's above 45 degrees. Ticks are active. People become active, especially in the summer months. So we have this combination of when ticks start to become active, when it warms up, and people start to get outdoors more and go into tick habitats. Woodsy areas, brushy areas, people like to do gardening, people like to go hiking and for walks. And so people just need to be aware of where ticks live, right? So ticks tend to live in shaded, brushy or wooded areas, not out in open fields where grass is cut short, places like that. Ticks will not thrive in those conditions. So whenever you're out and about on a nice spring or summer day, you need to be aware that ticks are going to be living in tall grasses, wherever the woods sort of meets the edge of an open field. Those are some real tick danger zones. So when you're in those areas, you just need to be aware that ticks live there and that they are looking for a blood meal, and you are among the people or animals that they might feed on.
Is there any particular blood type that they like more? Because I heard that like mosquitoes tend to like a particular blood type over another. I mean, they'll obviously go for anything.
But yeah.
I mean, are ticks like that at all? I mean, if you're an O type blood, does it just not matter?
No, it doesn't matter at all. They will grab onto, if you've ever seen pictures of ticks engaging in this behavior called questing, it's when they climb onto the edge of a leaf or a blade of grass or something. So all you have to do is brush by a tick, they'll latch onto you, they'll find a nice concealed spot they love behind the knee where there are folds in the skin, elbows, nape of the neck, armpits, groin, behind the ear is a real favorite spot. They will crawl to those places and they will start feeding on you. They don't care what blood type you have, how warm or cool you are, what kind of perfume you're wearing that day. It doesn't make a difference to them.
Now, of course, we talk or we hear so much about Lyme disease, but that isn't the only tick-borne sort of disease that people can get. Can you just talk us through maybe a couple of others?
The three main tick-borne diseases that we see in Connecticut are Lyme disease, number one. We see that about 10 times as often as anything else in terms of tick-borne diseases. The other two main ones are babesiosis and anaplasmosis. And there are a few other minor ones. We just see a little bit of Rocky Mountain spotted fever here. Despite its name, we do have that in Connecticut. And there's a new emerging one called Powassan virus, which everybody's very terrified of because when it infects you, it can be very serious. We've only seen about 100 cases in the country total in the last 10 years. So people may have heard of Powassan virus, really not a major concern right now, but we're keeping our eye on it.
So let's get back specifically to Lyme, because it does seem to be the one that everyone, you know, hears about, talks about. How big a problem is it? And is it growing? Are you seeing an increase?
So nationwide, we're seeing a lot more Lyme disease. So the number of cases and the rates of Lyme disease across the country are growing, and growing considerably in some areas.
And just how deadly is Lyme disease?
Yeah, we used to think that Lyme disease was never fatal. Never. More recently, we've identified there's some case fatalities with Lyme disease from Lyme carditis. So sometimes the bacteria can cause an inflammation in the tissue of the heart. And when the heart becomes inflamed, it can cause heart attacks and other problems. So Lyme carditis can be fatal, but it's exceedingly rare. So in the vast majority of cases, Lyme disease just makes you very sick. It doesn't kill you. Doesn't mean it's not a very severe disease. If it goes undiagnosed and untreated for a period of time, you can get these sort of late stage symptoms, which can be very, very severe. So some people will have memory problems, other neurological issues. They can have aches and pains in their big joints, severe arthritis in the knees and the hips. So it can be really debilitating disease. And in some people who, even after they're treated, they have what's called post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome, which are aches and pains and cognitive difficulties months and even years after they've been treated. So it can be a very severe disease, even though it's not often fatal.
So the big question, I suppose, really is, you know, what's the prevention things that you would advise, obviously, as a health district? Talk us through some of the things that people can do to try and reduce or prevent, tick attacks.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned prevention, because unfortunately, when it comes to Lyme disease, there is no vaccine. Okay, so a lot of infectious diseases we have vaccines for, and that's wonderful. but there is no vaccine for Lyme disease, or there is no longer a vaccine in the market for Lyme disease. So all the prevention that we have in our toolbox is really about personal protection. So steps that individuals can take to prevent getting tick bites, really. The basics, if you know you're going to be out in tick habitats, hiking, gardening, things like that, or if your work takes you into those habitats, if you're a landscaper, or if you work for a public works department, things like that, make sure to wear, if you can, light color clothing so that you can see ticks crawling on your clothing more readily. Wear long pants and long sleeve shirts. Tuck your pants into your socks. Tuck your shirt into your pants. Hopefully by the time you're done, you come indoors, you remove those clothes, put those clothes immediately in the dryer, high heat for 10 minutes. That will kill the ticks. Ticks do not survive well in hot, dry temperatures, which is why they like shady woodland environments. So kill the ticks in your dryer and then go bathe or shower immediately. So if you do have any ticks crawling on you, you can wash them off before they begin to bite you. The other things you can do is you can use insect repellents on your skin. So you can use anything that contains DEET. 30% is fine. Spray that on your skin. And despite what some people might think, it's fine for children, even young children, so long as they're about 6 months of age and older. And that will prevent the ticks from bite you. That masks your scent, so ticks sort of can't find you even though they're crawling on you. So you spray yourself with DEET and they're not likely to bite you. The other thing people can do is get an old chemical called permethrin. This is something that will kill ticks. You don't put it on your skin. You spray it on your clothing only. So you impregnate your clothes with this permethrin, and any ticks that come into contact with your clothing that's been sprayed with permethrin will die. So they won't ever get a chance to bite you. The good thing about permethrin is that once you spray it on your clothes, depending on how much you've sprayed, it can survive a few wash cycles. So you don't have to constantly, if you have your favorite gardening attire, or your favorite hiking attire, spray it down with permethrin, and it will survive a few washes, so you don't have to spray it every time. The other thing you can do is do full body tick checks. So if you've come indoors from gardening, from hiking, from being in tick habitats, check your body for ticks. So those are the main things you can do to prevent Lyme disease.
My thanks to Russell and the entire team at Ledgelight Health District. And Russell wanted us to also add that if you have any concerns or doubts, you might have been bitten by ticks and possibly have Lyme disease, to go and see your doctor, as symptoms can vary from person to person and can appear as much as 30 days after you've been in contact with ticks. You can also check out their website at llhd.org for more information about ticks. So joining me, as always, on Generations is Judy Jenks. Welcome back, Judy.
I'm glad to be here. It sort of caught me off guard.
I did, didn't I?
Yes.
So what are you going to talk to us about on this episode?
Summertime in the heat. As we age, we're less efficient at staying cool because we don't sweat as much. Some medications also reduce sweating. And our bodies store fat differently. I didn't know this, but we store fat differently, which complicates our heat regulation. Most heat-related deaths are people that are over 65. So they are a high-risk group that, you know, we probably didn't even really consider before. And so what to look for when you're around people is, are they dehydrated? Are they overdressed? We all know some of those people that are still wearing their sweatshirt, even though it's 80 degrees out. Are they on a salt-restricted diet? Because that also affects it. And medication that reduces sweating, and do they have certain chronic illnesses? So as we look at those things and we're out in the heat, what are the warning signs of a true emergency, a true heat-related emergency? Do they have a body temperature over 104? Is there a change in behavior? Are they confused, grouchy, agitated? They might be that way all the time. But if they're not and it's hot, maybe that's a sign. Do they have dry, flushed skin? Are they nauseous? Are they vomiting? Do they have a headache? Do they have heavy breathing, a rapid pulse, not sweating even though it's very hot? And perhaps they're even fainting. If those things are taking place, then you really want to assess that it's a real emergency and you want to call 911.
There's also sort of like cooling centers sometimes yes. spring up as well. Yes. So that's also beneficial, I suppose, to know where your sort of local cooling center is. And if all else fails, I suppose you can always pop down to either your local shopping mall or your library, can't you?
And that's exactly what they talk about.
Ah.
And so, and to be in air conditioning, because some people don't like it.
Mm.
So, but to go into air conditioning for 2 to 3 hours can have a huge effect overall. It gives your body a rest. You're right about going to the shopping center. Good time to do your shopping. Take your time. Go to the library. Go to the movies. Go to the senior center. Be in the air conditioning for a few hours and get some relief.
The other thing, I always try to do, and this isn't just, you know, if I'm out shopping, but even in the car as well. You know, once you've got that air conditioning on, yeah, you feel cool. But of course, the air conditioning can dry you out a bit as well. So, I always make sure I've got some bottles of water at the very minimum.
Yes.
So, again, I suppose that's just another thing to try and remember is you might be feeling cool because of the air conditioning, but actually you should still be drinking the water as well, shouldn't you?
We need to stay hydrated. We lose the ability to conserve water as we age, which affects our sweating. So you should have a drink with every meal and then have something you're sipping on all day to stay hydrated. You also want to talk to your doctor because some medications are less affected if they're stored in an area where the temperature is above 78. Mm. So if you don't have air conditioning, you don't want to use it, then you need to talk to your doctor, your pharmacist, on how you should store your medication. We don't want preventable health conditions aggravated by the high room temperature. So if you have some of those health conditions and it's too hot, you might want to consider getting air conditioning. If you can't afford to get air conditioning, you could contact the Area Agency on Aging or call 211 and see if there are programs out there that would help you get it if you have limited income.
While I've got you here as well, I always ask you about your Alexa. How are you getting on with your Alexa?
I have to tell you, I came home from work yesterday and my husband had it on playing music and I was shocked because I didn't even know he knew how to use it, never mind that he would use it. So we are becoming very comfortable with Alexa.
Good stuff. I think it's going to be a running theme. We'll probably ask you about Alexa every episode to see where you're at with it.
Yes. I love the fact that I can get any music that pops into my head. So if I want to listen to the blues, I just ask and poof, it appears. You know, I want to listen to the Beatles, I want to listen to jazz, and poof, it appears. I don't have to look for it, I don't need to find the station for it, none of that, so I love it.
And you can probably get some good health tips from Alexa as well if you ask it.
Oh, the questions. And so we've started, you know, you have people over and something comes up and you ask questions. And we have questions Alexa doesn't know the answer to.
Judy, as always, it's a pleasure talking to you. Thank you ever so much. And of course, we'll catch you on the next episode.
Yes, we will.
Take care.
Thank you.
That's all from this edition of Generations. Don't forget to visit seniorcentrect.org to find out what's going on in your neck of the woods. And if you want to send us a topic to talk about or want to be our guest on the podcast, drop us a line by visiting the seniorcentrect.org website. Go to the bottom of the homepage and click the How to Advertise with Us link to get in touch. From myself, Brian Scott Smith, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.